From Boca Raton, Florida, this is Behind the Bima. On this episode, the rabbis are joined by Jay Feinberg, founder and CEO of Gift of Life Marrow Registry. Jay shares the miraculous story that led to his founding a life-changing organization, discusses the importance of positivity in his life, and previews the exciting things happening at Gift of Life. Plus, what changes in shul might stay even as the world returns to normal? And what would everyone say good riddance to in 2020? All this and more Behind the Bima.
Welcome to Behind the Bima. It's Wednesday night, 9 o'clock. I'm your host, Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg, joined by my one co-host, Rabbi Moskowitz, here on this Wednesday night, 9 o'clock. This is a first for Behind the Bima. We are from 3 down to 2. One of our co-hosts is...
Man down.
We're not sure exactly what's going on, but hopefully he will join us. In the meantime, so far so good, you know? Anybody wants to come on, jump on as a guest panelist tonight, let us know. We'll figure out a way to get you on. We got a very exciting night tonight. We have a... Not often that you could say that your guest is also one of your heroes. Literally a hero. And there was our first literally 30 seconds into the show. But used appropriately, because Jay Feinberg is literally a hero. As you'll see when you'll learn more from his story, his extraordinary story of his survival, the fact that he's alive and what he did with that gift of being alive. You know, it's been said famously, so famous I just don't remember who said it, that the two most important days of your life are the day you're born and the day you figure out why. Well, Jay knows why he, I don't know why he was born, but why he was given a second chance at life, because he's given so many others a chance at life. So Rabbi Moskowitz, I know you in particular are really excited to welcome Jay on tonight. Tell us why.
Yeah, well, Jay, when he was, he'll tell a little bit about it, you know, when he comes on, but he was in Boston at the beginning of this journey and the process for him many, many years ago. And when they first started the bone marrow drives, it started from Boston, and CJP, Combined Jewish Philanthropies, which is the federation in Boston, was very involved in getting it off the ground. And I vividly remember being at some of the first bone marrow drives to try to get matches. And I remember my job was to sit at the door, and they needed to lower the cost. It was very expensive at the time to find, to test people. So they figured if we put a little kid at the door and ask people for money, people are much more likely to give money. So I still remember my line. I told people, I said, would you like to give to help defray the cost of the testing? And I had no idea what the word defray meant at the time, but I knew that I was told to memorize that word and to say it over and over again. And so, you know, we, Jay, way back, already beginning of the process, Jay was at my bar mitzvah. He had Galila at my bar mitzvah. And thank God we've stayed in touch for a very long time. I remember fondly Jay's parents, Jay's mother in particular, who I know passed away a couple of years ago. And I was very close with our family. And we have a picture for our guests who are coming, who are going to stay on for when Jay comes. We have a picture that is going to surprise everyone. So we go way back with Jay. It's been extraordinary, not only to see him healthy, which in and of itself is a miracle, but as you alluded to see what he has built and to see what he has accomplished and to see the number of lives that he has impacted is nothing short of extraordinary. And your usage of literally was the perfect word.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And it is exciting. And it's exciting to know how far back the two of you go. And we've been able to forge relationships because Gift of Life is headquartered right here in Boca Raton, which is a great point of pride for Boca Raton. So we'll bring Jay on in a couple minutes. But I wanted to check back with you, Rabbi Moskowitz. Last week when we had our show, you were concerned whether you would survive, speaking of survival, through Friday night, that you had to fast the Asara B'Teves last Friday. You were worried that the chazan might prolong the davening. You wouldn't get home to make kiddush. You live far from shul. Did you give our listeners an update? Did you make it through the fast? Did you get home, in fact, Friday night? How would you rate the Baal Tefillah last Friday night? Did he hit the right pace? Too fast? Too slow? Did we sing? How would you say it was?
Baal Tefillah was perfect. I will tell you, there's a rabbi in the shul who gave a short sermon before Kabbalah Shabbos, which was breaking me out in the heebie-jeebies. I was looking at the clock a little bit. But I think the fast ended at 6:14. And my son and I were walking home. It was like 6:13 as we're coming up my block. And I'm like, this is like the perfect story for a yeki like myself. I'm going to come in the door at 6:14. We're going to make kiddush. It's going to be the perfect ending to a fast day. And just as I'm walking up my block, I see someone coming at me. Rabbi, can I ask you a question?
The old rabbi.
And that stalled me.
The killer. Well, you know, first of all, whatever rabbi that was that shared brilliant, wise remarks to introduce that prayer to go from Gullus to Geula, from the fast and the exile to the redemption, that Rabbi hit it right on the mark. Because even you, who have one of the furthest walks, made it home right when the fast was over. Imagine if he didn't speak. You would have been home at your clock.
I would have been home early. Watch,
waiting for the fast to end. Thank God for that, Rabbi. That's all I can say. I don't know if you saw the meme that was going around. It was a great one. It said, this Friday night, women are going to all find out what time shul really ends Friday night because those husbands are going to be home. So, Rabbi, you made it. It's fascinating that after last week's show, we continued to get feedback from listeners about this conundrum. Which is harder, to make it through the davening Friday night after a fast or Shavuos morning after staying up all night? I will say I got a lot of votes on my side. I got several pieces of feedback. The torture of staying up all night. So we're happy to hear
that. All I was thinking is that, you know, in response to the rabbi who gave a little bit of, I'll even call it like a short sermet on Friday night. Maybe I'll give a little short sermet on Shavuos morning and ask people, you know, maybe before Akdamas on Shavuos morning, I'll give a little bit of a sermonette to inspire people and to motivate them for davening on Shavuos.
Well, I, for one, would welcome it, but I wouldn't, because listening when you've stayed up all night is much harder than listening when you're fasting for a few hours. Big deal. Some of us have plenty of reserves and we're good to go. We are, the vaccine has begun to be distributed. Everybody knows that. We are an apolitical show, so we're not going to talk about why there is so much of a more of a struggle to give it out here in America versus in Israel, where they have mastered giving it out. I saw a statistic that they believe that in 10 days, everyone over 60 years old in Israel will have been vaccinated. That's extraordinary. For a country that the post office is difficult to navigate, that is really, really impressive. We're having a hard time here. But as people are getting it, it's time to start thinking about some of the things. And the question is of bringing them back when we'll have the ability to return more and more to normal. And we've talked about this before, but it's even more on our minds about what we bring back. Are we going to bring back Kiddush and Shul Friday night? Adam Zmiro Shabbos morning? Are we ever going to bring back shaking hands or making Mishaberachs? Are these types of things we're going to bring back? What do you think? What do you miss? What do you wish? What do you want to have back?
Well, I'll preface it by saying that I think these are the most challenging situations to deal with, right? When it was a matter of shutting down or not shutting down, it was black and white, right? You shut down, you open up. It's the nuance of these issues, which I think makes it so complicated. And because it's such a slow rollout of the vaccine, I think very soon we're going to have people that are going to be banging down our door saying we want a vaccine minion, where we're a little bit more looser in the restrictions, and we're going to have other people that aren't going to have the vaccine. And I think that middle area, that gray area, is going to it's going to make it a little complicated for the decision makers and schools and shuls over the next couple of months. Listen, obviously, I love all davening. I love Anim Zmiros. I love Yedi Nefesh. I love everything. But one could argue that there's something nice about a more streamlined davening. I know for myself personally, and this was unexpected, but I love saying Pesukei Dezimra to myself on Shabbos morning. Mm. I love being able to pace myself. I know exactly how long it's going to take me. I'm not beholden to anyone else's time schedule. And there's something so calming about just saying Pesukei Dezimra on your own, right, to your own. And you know this as well as I do. As people come into shul, the hum in the shul builds up. And sure, I sit in the front, so I don't see it, but I feel it behind me, like the number of people that come in. So, you know, obviously we love all davening, but I also love the fact that it's a little bit more streamlined. I don't miss the Misha Beirachs in between Aliyahs. I like the fact that the next guy's up there, it moves a little bit faster. How about you? What are you gonna miss?
You know, I'll tell you the truth. As we continue down this road, I think we'll have the opportunity to talk more and more about this, but I will just close this because I want to bring Jay on. You know, most time we could spend with him, the better. But I'll close this by appealing to the listeners and those watching to have some rahmanas, have some mercy on people in leadership positions. And what I mean by that is there's difficult decisions. This is a year of decision-making. It's a year of decision-making for everyone personally, everyone, their comfort zone, their best practices, responsibility, certain decisions people have to make. And there's enormous decision fatigue that has set in. It probably set in 8 months ago, and yet we're running on fumes at this point. But those in leadership positions, school, shul, and much more, we can talk to Jay about this too, you know, there's enormous decision fatigue, and this is not a time to get tired because some of the biggest decisions are yet ahead of us. Like you just said, will we demand vaccination for corona the way we do for measles, mumps, polio and other diseases? When will we remove masks? When will we take away distancing? Will we allow vaccine minyanim or vaccine classrooms? What will be the policies and the practices? There's a lot of really, really difficult decisions ahead. And, you know, when you're in your armchair spectator, you know, easy from home on your couch, judging and criticizing everyone's decisions, the answers are always simple and clear. But when you're sitting behind the desk, when you're having to make those decisions and live with the consequences of them, it's a lot harder. So whether it's a decision like Anam Zmiros, there are kids whose whole memory, their childhood, their love of shul is connected to leading Anam. I remember first time I led Anam Zmiros, my first cousin, Yona Lazar, several years older than I am. I was a little boy, his bar mitzvah. I trained, I practiced. It was the big unveiling. I have an older sister, but I'm the older boy in my family. I was the first Anam Zmiros. I vividly remember that. And that has an impact on me. So we're going to deny and rob kids their Anam Zmiros. Their first stage appearance was on the Bima for Anam Zmiros. Forget behind the Bima, on the Bima. So we're going to deprive kids of that. On the other hand, Anam Zmiros, people talking, reading Parsha printouts, having their back to the open Aron. Are we really running to bring that back? They're difficult decisions is my point. Have Rachmanis, heads of school, principals, lay leaders, rabbis, professional leaders, even elected officials. And the medical and science community, you know, look with a watchful, critical eye, offer good feedback, but have some rachmanis. That's my appeal.
It's funny. I was doing a webinar for YU today, and you know, they gave me a list of questions. And okay, yeah, they gave me a list of questions to in advance, and so I prepared some thoughts on each of the questions. And then he asked me one question off the cuff. What was the question? What is BRS doing for Pesach? And I literally spit out. I was like, Pesach. He's like, yeah, Pesach's only 3 months away. What is BRS doing? Yeah, by the way, yes, Pesach is only 3 months away. I said, if you think we know what we're doing, do you know how much can change between now and Pesach? You're asking us what we're going to be for Pesach.
Of course we know what we're doing. We're BRS. We know exactly what we're
BRS.
Doing. All I know is this. We can't reveal it yet, but it's going to be incredible.
It's going to be
what
huge.
We're doing for Pesach, it's enormous. It's like never seen before. It's really going to be fantastic. Let's just say I got a call from a major Pesach program. And I was excited, like maybe they want to talk to me. And they're like, you know, Rabbi, you've been with us before. Someday we'd love to have you again, but do you think you could connect us with Ben Shapiro? So if there's anything to really make you feel good about yourself, it's when you get those phone calls. In any case, let's get to our real hero of the day. We could talk a lot more about summarizing the year 2020 as we end the Gregorian calendar. But before we bring him on board, let's talk about Jay Feinberg. I mean, who doesn't know that name? Like you and I was growing up, Jay Feinberg. I didn't grow up in Boston. I didn't know him personally. He wasn't at my bar mitzvah as he was for you. But we all knew his name because even before social media awareness, we knew the Jay Feinberg bone marrow drives that were going on all over the place. We knew that there was a young man, a little bit older than I, but a young man whose life depended on it. And there were drives everywhere. We heard that name. And Jay, of course, had leukemia. Countless drives were done for him. And this is actually the 25th anniversary of his transplant that saved his life. So it's a very significant year and a really wonderful time to be able to have him on and to be able to celebrate this. It was 1991, his first year of law school. He was diagnosed with leukemia. His family was told he needed a bone marrow transplant. But there were no matching donors in his family or in the whole national registry. So can you imagine you go through the national registry, you're waiting, and there's nothing there. And for 4 years, that's why we know the name, because it was drives, not for a week or a month or a year. 4 years. His health was deteriorating. 60,000 donors had been tested. Matches were made for hundreds of other patients, but not one for him. And it was really running towards the end. His health had deteriorated so much that it was really desperate times. And we'll bring Jay on to tell the end of that story. But before we bring him on, and I'll do it not in front of him because he's so humble and so modest. If you've been to the Gift of Life, you know, we've been to the walks and we've seen it. And he's so modest and humble that you would never believe that the guy we're about to bring on, he has been awarded the Hadassah International Citizen of the World Award. He was awarded the Charles Bronfman Prize for a dedication. He has an honorary doctorate from Yeshiva University along with Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton that year. He was awarded the Jewish Community Hero Award by Jewish Federations of North America. He was named one of the top 100 individuals positively influenced Jewish life. He was received the prestigious Eisendrach Bearer of Light Award, and he was awarded the Communal Leadership Award at Arevut 5th Annual Bergen County Breakfast. Go Bergen County. So all of that, you'd expect that there's like some really charged, energetic, suck the air out of the room guy who comes on, but there couldn't be anything further from the truth. Instead, it is really our pleasure tonight to be able to welcome on one of our heroes, Jay Feinberg. Jay, welcome. It is great to have you, my friend.
Hi. And neighbor. Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure. Our pleasure, Jay. How are you doing, first of all? How are you managing through this virus? Tell you how you've been getting through. How are you been able to run, even before we get to the rest of your story, which obviously, spoiler alert, thank God you found your match and you're here and you've made a big difference with it. But you have a magnificent campus in Boca Raton. You have a staff. You are changing the world and saving lives. Has that been able to operate as usual? Has that been halted? Tell us about what life has been like the last 8 months for Gift of Life.
Yeah. So, you know, certainly with COVID, there have been a number of challenges since we transport bone marrow and stem cells all over the world and, you know, dealing with flight cancellations and, you know, border closings and quarantines and all of these different things. But you know, thankfully, we've been getting through it, and no patient has not had a transplant. Every single patient that needed one received one. In fact, we did 20% more transplants this year than last year. It's just been very busy, and thankfully, we've been able to help everyone in need.
Why do you think that is, 20% more? Are there more matches? Have there been more people who need it?
So, I think most important is that the registry is growing much faster than it did before. So with more donors going into the registry, we're able to match more patients. So, and it happened that the year before was a very busy year with recruitment. We swabbed and tested over 50,000 people. Our 5-year plan actually is by 2025 to be at 1 million donors. So we're looking forward to that.
Wow. 1 million donors. Okay, before we get there, Jay, let's take a step back because we really jumped the gun, and let's fill in this story a little bit. So, sure. You know, we were talking about all the awards you've won. You talked about the difference that you've made. The statistics are absolutely astounding that you've done over almost 11,000 bone marrow drives, 50 countries, almost 400,000 registered donors, 18,000 matches, and big shout out, quick props to BRS members, Avi Amsalam, Peril Handy, Matthew Hockerman, our good buddy, John Struhl, who have themselves matched, just members of our shul itself, who've made a difference. And you've facilitated almost 4,000 transplants. It's really, really extraordinary what you've accomplished through Gift of Life. But all of that almost didn't happen. Take us back to 1991. What was it like? How old were you? 4 years of watching drive after drive after drive, matches for others, none for you. What did that feel like? What was that like?
Yeah. So, you know, it, I think like any patient who's diagnosed with a life-threatening disease, it was overwhelming at first. And it was hard to see that light at the end of the tunnel. But I think what made it all possible for me was seeing the outpouring of support from the Jewish community. You know, when we did our first drive in New Jersey, and we really didn't know what to expect, it was at a synagogue just across the street from our house in West Orange. You know, we went to the drive, and when we got there, there was a crowd and a huge line coming out the door, down the sidewalk, into the street, and the police were there doing crowd control. And it just shows you how the community comes out for, you know, some people knew me, but a lot of people didn't know who I was. They come out for a total stranger to hopefully, God willing, save a life. And when we started seeing that happen, all spread like virally all across the country. And this was, as you mentioned, you know, before you know, the web, before social media, you know, this was all, you know, word of mouth and newspaper articles and such. But it really just exploded all over the country, in Canada, in Israel, in Australia. That's what got me through it, was knowing that there were so many strangers out there willing to save the life of a total stranger in need.
Where did you ever feel like you were running out of time? Did you ever feel like you were giving up hope? Where did the role of, you know, obviously family is enormous, the way they were devoted to you, what they did, that go to the ends of the earth, and community, as you just described, the Jewish people, how they responded. Did faith play a role for you? How did you stay optimistic? Again, you were a young man at the time, although not a kid. How did you maintain hope and faith as not 1 year, two or three, 4 years into a drive, and time was running out? And we'll get to the story, which is just an amazing story, but time was running out. How did you stay positive? How did you maintain your hope?
So Philip knows the answer to this question because he knew my mother. And she was not the type of Jewish mother that would take no for an answer. I don't think any Jewish mother takes no for an answer. So she would have kicked my butt if I was negative. So I was definitely always positive and always looking for that light at the end of the tunnel. And it was just the support out there. You know, when you get sick with any condition, in particular life-threatening disease, you very quickly learn who your friends are. And for me, it was all those people that I didn't know who became my friends. You know, people like Philip and his wonderful family and his father of blessed memory, who's such an incredible guy. I mean, you know, these are the people who really made it possible for me to have a positive attitude and get through all of this.
If you look right now, and those listening on the podcast can't hear it, but those who are watching see, there's a picture of Rabbi Moskowitz, his father, of blessed memory, Olav Shalom, with Jay at a drive. And we have another picture, but it's too dark, of Rabbi Moskowitz's mom helping run a drive. And on the bottom right is Jay in the hospital getting the transplant. And the bottom left, I don't want to ruin the story, we'll come back to it in a moment, was actually his hero. But could you just reiterate for one more moment, and I want our other rabbis to be able to chime in here also, I'm sorry, but the role of positivity again. You know, your mom made sure there was no negativity because she understood that a negative energy wasn't going to help, was just going to deplete whatever strength that you had left. So does that inform what you do at Gift of Life, both with your staff and the patients, to inject and make sure that there's a real positive energy? Would you tell those listening, whatever they're going through, be it health-related, corona-related, how important is positive attitude?
It's incredibly important. You know, to me, it makes all the difference. You know, you need to stay positive and have that positive attitude, and that's really what gets you through it. You know, having family and friends and community, and knowing that they stand by you and support you and they're there for you in need, that really gets you through things. I have to say that I think that having a positive attitude plays an important role in your health, both psychologically and physically. I really, really do. So I encourage everybody to find that sense of positivity and seek the help of your community and everyone who can be there for you. It's important that everybody knows that they're not alone.
Absolutely. I'm just going to finish the story of Moskowitz, then I'm going to hand it off to you. So 60,000 donors, matches for hundreds of others, but none for you, Jay, 4 years in. You tell the story. What happened? How did they finally find your match? What drive? How did that story unfold? And a reminder to people that it wasn't a cheek swab at the time. When we were kids, all the Jane Feiberg bone marrow drives were needles. So how did that play a role? Tell us the rest of the story.
Yeah, so the drives, as you mentioned before, went on for 4 years, during which time I was on chemotherapy that was controlling the leukemia. But into the beginning of the fourth year, the chemo stopped working, and the doctors suggested that I go with a donor who we had tested in Israel. She was actually from Long Island, but she was in seminary in Israel. We decided to go with her, even though she was a multiple mismatch and the odds were slim, but it was certainly better than doing nothing. And it was at that point that a young man from Chicago named Benji Merzel decided to run one last donor drive with someone you know, Amir Gutman. And they ran that drive together, not in Chicago, but in Milwaukee at the Wisconsin Institute of Torah Study. I believe they rented a van that morning. They drove from Chicago to Milwaukee. Benji's mother was actually the phlebotomist drawing the blood that day. And one of his neighbors was supposed to join them to help volunteer, hand out flyers, et cetera. But she couldn't go that morning. So her sister went in her place. And I think they tested about 130 people that day. And at the end of the day, this young lady, Becky, who had come to help out, who was needle phobic and was afraid to do it, decided, you know what, I'm going to do it. So draw the blood quickly and let's get this done. She did it. She was the last person tested. And as you can imagine, she turned out to be my miracle match.
It's just an amazing story. The very last drive after 4 years and the last person of the last drive. And an amazing part of the story is, as you said, Becky was afraid of needles. So she volunteered to help, but she said, I'm not getting tested. And as they were cleaning up, she said, you know what? I'm here already. Who knows? Let me just do it so I could say I did it. The last person, the last drive, 4 years, and you are here. And Rabbi Moskowitz, let's take it from there, because Jay, what you've done with that second lease on life is amazing.
First of all, you know, I've heard the story maybe a million times, and every time it's so emotional for me, Jay, to be able to be here with you tonight. You know, so many people speak about moments in their lives that influence them. And for many people, it was Soviet Jewry from a different generation. Really, for me, it was the drives for Jay Feinberg that was such an important part of my childhood and my awareness of activism and love for every Jew, or for anyone, depending on whether you knew the person or not. And obviously, we got to know it at that first drive. We didn't know you very well. And you just did it because it was the right thing to do. And so you continue to make an impact on my life. And in many ways, your story has shaped so much of who I am. And as you alluded to, so much of my family. You know, my question is, I've never had a chance to ask you this. So many people go through life-changing experiences. So many people have had leukemia, have had cancer, have had experiences like this. And many of them are motivated to try things in the short term and say, okay, because of my experience, I want to go small and try something small. When did you realize that this wasn't just going to be a life experience for you, but this was going to be a calling for you, that you were going to take what happened to you and really build this empire of goodness for the world, where you were going to help millions of people? When did that click in your head that this was more than just Jay Feinberg, that this is something that you can give back to the world and that you could contribute to everybody else?
Yeah, you know, to me, and I think to my family as well, it was a matter of paying it forward and knowing that there were so many other patients out there in similar circumstances who weren't finding matches. And we had, you know, built up such a momentum with all of these drives, testing, you know, between 50 and 60,000 people and helping so many people out there in similar circumstances. And there were so many more that needed help that we couldn't not do it. You know, I remember that, you know, I had this talk with my parents quite a bit because I had just was just starting law school when I got sick. And I remember that after my transplant and after I recovered from my transplant, the dean of the law school called and said, you know, are you ready to come back? And that's when I told him, I'm not coming back. You can give the seat to somebody else. You know, it really was something that needed to be done. I don't think there was any question. It really wasn't.
Now, I've been to, and we'll get into this a little bit more, but anyone who's ever been to the Gift of Life Center in Boca Raton, it's unbelievable. I mean, that's really, I was there, I think, 2 years ago with you. You hosted me, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I mean, the state of the art, really the attention to detail that pervades every element of that building is extraordinary. You obviously didn't have the natural qualifications for that, right? And as you didn't go through the natural channels, but you had to grow with the organization. Give us a little bit of insight. What's that been like, where you've had to kind of qualify for the job as you go along, and you've done so with such excellence, right? What are the tricks of the trade? It's basically self-taught, correct? I mean, much of what you've done has been by sheer passion and ambition. Walk us through that a little bit.
So, before my transplant, there were two things that I was most afraid of in life, and they were blood and public speaking. So, you know, you face your fears. my background was economics and political science. So, you know, going into the field of medicine, and, you know, bone marrow and stem cell transplant was very foreign, but, you know, when your life is on the line, it's really a crash course in whatever you need to learn to make it happen. And then it was just continuing to extend that, throughout, you know, my recovery and into a Gift of Life and becoming a global registry. So you know, that's really what it took. You know, it was just that determination to make it happen, learn what I needed to learn and grow it from there. And I'm thankful that, you know, I just have a wonderful team at Gift of Life who makes it very easy for me to do what I do. They're truly outstanding, and I'm really blessed.
Do you have any particular mentors, anyone who from a business, right? You're the CEO of an enormous Tell us about Gift of Life for a moment, even before I ask that question. How many employees do you have? How much testing? How big is the database? How big is the annual budget? How much fundraising responsibility? Give our listeners and us a sense of the scope of what Gift of Life, from a hospital bed and recovery and an idea and a law school dropout, what it's turned into.
Not bad for a law school dropout, by the way.
So it's grown dramatically.
Don't be humble. Tell us everything.
All right. So we're about 70 employees with a $16 million a year budget that's about to grow significantly with some new things that I'll share that are happening very, very soon. We are in a 25,000 square foot facility. We've accomplished some great things with the collection center, as Philip mentioned, and now a laboratory that we'll share in a minute. We have almost 400,000 donors in the registry. We're growing by about 50,000 donors a year when it's not COVID, and it's extraordinary. You know, this year we'll transplant about 240 patients, and by 2025, our goal is to hit 1 million donors and be transplanting close to 1,000 patients a year.
Right. And transplanting is not like, you know, I don't know. Transplanting is saving a life, right? Let me loosely translate the word transplant, save a life. So right. Our goal is to save 1,000 lives a year, right? The globe would be lacking those 1,000 people. Sons and daughters and mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters would be gone. But because of the thing that we're building, our goal is to save 1,000 souls, 1,000 lives a year. That's, I just have to reiterate that. So coming back to Rabbi Moskowitz's question, because, you know, we, the rabbis on this group, we love productivity, business. It's the entrepreneurship spirit that we try to bring to BRS and what we do. How'd you learn it? Was there a mentor? Did you go to a crash course at Harvard in the summer? Were there people on your board who have experience building big things that have been able to give you that feedback? Could have all the drive and passion. How do you have the skill set to do it?
So it actually started at Philip's bar mitzvah, believe it or not. So at your bar mitzvah, Barry Schrag, who at the time was the president of Combined Jewish Philanthropies, told me the great news that he had come up with $10,000 to send a volunteer to Belarus to do testing in the area where the shtetl was located, where my father's family came from, and that was where the challenging tissue type or challenging antigen was from. And the person who we sent to Belarus for 6 weeks of his life, having blood drawn from people and testing people, turned out to ultimately continue to be involved and actually was our board chairman for many years, is now our chairman emeritus, and is an extraordinary guy. His name is Bill Beagle. And he taught me something very, very important. He taught me the concept of the BHAG, or the big, hairy, audacious goal. And our big, hairy, audacious goal is to ensure that no patient dies for lack of a donor, to democratize cell therapy and ensure that there is equal opportunity for everybody out there who can benefit from the treatment that can give them that second chance. And that's what it's all about. So that's who I learned from.
So let's take one moment while we're at it and tell us about this story and what people can do for this 3.5-year-old.
Yeah. So Sloan is 3.5 years old. I sent you a video, which hopefully you got to see, and maybe we could share it with everybody afterwards.
Sure.
She's an amazing, vivacious child, so full of love. She has a beautiful sister as well, and they're just wonderful. But Sloan unfortunately has a couple of challenging health problems. One in particular is a type of pre-leukemia that can only be treated with a bone marrow transplant. And unfortunately, she doesn't have a match. So like me, she's looking to the Jewish community, because she's Jewish, to do one of these cheek swabs here with the hope that one of those people might be the match. And what's important for everybody to remember is that my donor, Becky, did this And she was the last person tested, as we spoke about at the last drive. And to remember that it only takes one person to save a life, and it could be any one of us. So anybody who's looking and saying, well, why do I need to do it? You know, what are the odds that I'll be a match? That's where you have to remember that it only takes one person, and it could be any one of us. So it's
what could people do? Yeah. What would they do if they want to be tested?
Right here. They go to the website, giftoflife.org. They fill out an online health form. We send them this kit in the mail, swab their cheek, send it back. We get it tested at the lab, and they go into the registry.
It's crazy how much the process has changed. There are people that still aren't swabbed. I mean, you imagine with all the publicity and the amazing inroads that you've made into the Jewish community, it's astounding that there are people that are still not swabbed. Where are they, and how can we better spread the word? I mean, I know you've spoken about college students and a focus on that population in particular.
Yeah, so we do the biggest recruitment efforts that we have are with Birthright Israel, where we swab all the kids who go to Israel on Birthright each year, and on college campuses. And we have partnerships with Hillel, Chabad on campus, AEPI. We have lots of great organizations that help us recruit on campus. We have close to 400 college students who intern for us on 100 campuses across the country. And that plays certainly an important role. But it's also just getting it out there in our communities. I wish that everybody was in the registry, but unfortunately that's not the case. And part of it is because of the misconception that people have about what's involved in being a donor. You know, a lot of people get that education from, TV shows and from movies where they exaggerate what the process is really about and make it seem very scary. But I think you know from coming to the office and seeing the Stem Cell Collection Center that it's really very far from the case, that it's actually almost like a spa. You know, you come for a few hours and you just have some blood taken out of one arm, just like a platelet donation. And we take out the stem cells and put the blood back in the other arm. You watch a Netflix movie. You get fresh baked chocolate chip cookies. You get taken care of like a king or a queen, and then you go home when it's done and you've saved a life.
I was amazed because I visited, Matthew Hockerman, our dear friend, who donated twice, and I visited him in the hospital in Jersey. I happened to be there, and I was amazed. You know, he had the Gift of Life blanket on top of him, a great touch. You get professionalism, the excellence Rabbi Moskowitz mentioned, and you're right. You know, that's not to take away from what a selfless thing it is to donate when you're a match. It's still a very, very selfless thing, but it's not a scary thing, and that's important for people to know. Jay, could you clarify, because a lot of comments are flooding in right now, questions. People want to know, is there an age limit? Up to what age would they swab? Someone's asking, is there a place in New York? But you don't have to go anywhere to be swabbed. You can just order the kit right off the internet, right, and send that back, and from the comfort of your home, just do a swab.
Yeah, just order it from giftoflife.org. So you can, anybody from the age of 18 through 60 can join the registry. But I will say that 90% of the donors who get called for patients in need are between the ages of 18 and 35. So we really encourage the younger donors tend to be requested more, because the younger you are, the more stem cells your bone marrow produces in your body, which is better for the patients. So certainly anybody is welcome to join the registry during that age, throughout that age range.
Rabbi Brody, on location.
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
We hear you.
Okay. I just want to say, first of all, there is a part of the website that I remember my wife and I were saying, where we tested. And you can actually go on the website to put in your name, and it can throw back. If you don't remember being tested 20 years ago, there's a database that can show you that.
Yes.
A number of years ago, I think it was probably about 2 years ago, I don't know if you host this every year, but there was at the local, one of the local hotels, you had a big convention. And I remember walking into the ballroom and seeing that there were what seemed like hundreds of people. Each one of those people were representing one of the colleges where you have some form of a group on a college campus. And there are literally hundreds of people that are leading these groups and these efforts to help you recruit for donations. And, I'm just wondering, we're always talking about trying to get the Jews on college campuses. to care about something, whether it's Israel, whether it's any other important issue. How did you do that? How did you bring all these college leaders? These are not just students. These are the leaders leading and recruiting other students.
Yeah, so we started the Campus Ambassador Program in 2015, and it was really just a pilot project with five campus ambassadors on five campuses, and it just did really well. So year over year we were throwing all kinds of marketing information out there in social media, et cetera, encouraging people to look into it and apply. And after the first 2 years, we didn't have to do that anymore. People were coming to us. So we actually received more applications than we can actually handle every year. And this year now, we're, I think, around 400 students, and it'll continue to grow. It's just, it's almost taken on a life of its own. It really has. I think what motivates them,
400 ambassadors, not 400 college students that are active. These are the ones that are leading?
Yes, these are the ones that are leading it on their campuses.
Wow.
Jay, yeah. you still have a fear of public speaking?
Not anymore.
You got over
it. The blood is a different story. No. The blood is
blood. Tell us how you got over it. Was it just that you found yourself having to speak over and over again? You have any tips? Those who are listening who have fears and phobias, what are your tips? What helped you get over the public speaking? Was it the fact that just the stakes were so high, you had to save lives?
I'm picturing you all, like sitting there in your underwear right now.
That is definitely a tip. That is one strategy.
You do it for a good cause, and that's really what it's all about. You do it because you know that it's going to help people. I'm doing this tonight with you, number one, because I respect you guys so much. It's an honor to do it. But I'm really doing it because I'm hoping that the one person out there who's not in the registry is going to do it. And that one person is going to save Sloan's life.
Wow. Wow. It really is amazing. Jay, you're extraordinary. You've done extraordinary things with your lease on life, and total thank you to Becky and to Rabbi Amir Gutman, as you mentioned, and Benji was his name, the other one who ran
Benji
that drive.
Yep.
Yeah, because there's so many lessons in this story, one of which is put yourself out there. God needs partners, and he's telling us do our part and he'll come through. So even after 4 years and drives that didn't find a match, there was a group who said, let's do one more. And there was a young lady who said, fine, put a needle in me, even though I'm afraid of them. And if we all push ourselves a little bit and we leave our comfort zone and we act with a little more selflessness, you don't know the difference you can make. You could save someone spiritually, emotionally, psychologically, and physically. And all of those are forms of saving lives. And it must be so gratifying for you to go home every night after a day of work and know that you are doing the business of saving Jewish lives, saving lives in general. It's really, really amazing. A big yeshar koach to you. And Hashem, God should just continue to give you the strength and the wisdom and the courage to be able to keep doing what you're doing. And we are here to help you and partner with you in what you're doing. And you really are an inspiration to us all.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Really means a lot to me and to all the patients out there.
We appreciate your being on tonight. Any closing thoughts? Anything you want to leave us with?
No, just encouraging those people who are not in the registry to go ahead and do it. As I said, it just takes one person, and Sloan is waiting, and she's right here in Boca. She's right down the street from me, actually. So let's do it. Let's find her match and celebrate her getting that life-saving transplant.
And when we do, and it turns out it was someone who was listening to Behind the Bima, are we bringing you and Sloan and the donor back on the show?
You're gonna be the one introducing them.
Wow. Okay. Wow. Listen, everyone take a moment and think about Sloan. If she was your daughter, your niece, your granddaughter, like for the moment of swabbing your cheek, you could save a life. And if you're a match, then it's not hard. It's really amazing.
Wait, so. We can't let Jay go because Jay teased us with big news that's coming out of the Gift of Life offices, and he didn't reveal what the news was. So I've been waiting with bated breath the whole time.
Yes. So something exciting. We just opened just a couple of weeks ago our new Center for Cell and Gene Therapy, which is a cellular therapy laboratory. And one of the exciting things that we'll be doing is starting a biobank of cells that we will be collecting from donors that that will be available, what we call off the shelf, for patients who are in urgent need. So just like you go to you get a prescription from your doctor, you go to the pharmacy, they fill a prescription for you for the medication that you need to treat your disease. That's what we're talking about. Obviously, a little more complicated because it's not a pharmacy. You know, it's a biobank with big tanks of liquid nitrogen where the cells are stored. But the concept is the same, that we can treat patients much faster. You know, because the two challenges that we have are, number one, half the patients out there still can't find a match globally. And the second thing is that half of the patients who are lucky enough to find a match don't end up getting their transplant because it takes too long. By slashing that time, we can more than double the number of patients out there who will benefit and receive transplants. The other exciting thing is that donors will soon be called not just to donate marrow or stem cells to specific patients in need, but to donate cells for cell and gene therapy, which means that their cells can be used to develop these living drugs, so to speak, that can be used to treat patients with all kinds of blood disorders and even solid tumors going into the future, as these are developed and approved by the Food and Drug Administration. And if you can imagine a day where one donor, rather than donating to one patient, one donor has the ability to save the lives of hundreds of patients, pretty amazing.
It is. Wow. It is. One more question for you, Jay, before we let you go, because as you're speaking, it's occurring to me. What's your relationship with the state of Israel? State of Israel is 6-7 million Jews. Let's just get them all swabbed. And then, you know, you'll have seven times the registry, and we should be able to solve the problem.
Yeah. So thankfully, there are two registries in Israel who do a great job of recruiting. So it is being done. In fact, one of the other things that came out of Phil's bar mitzvah, so much has come out of your bar mitzvah, that Barry Schrag asked me to give a presentation at CJP headquarters to some representatives from the Ministry of Health a number of years ago. And I suggested to them that they test the IDF soldiers. And sure enough, they're testing the IDF soldiers. Wow. So Phil, your bar mitzvah has accomplished a lot of huge things.
Wow. Here, just as a tease, again, this is a picture of a very young Philip Moskowitz at a drive for Jay Feinberg wearing a Michigan Wolverine sweatshirt that I lived in for about 10 years of my life. And that is me at a drive for you, asking people to donate to defray the cost of the testing involved at the drive. Yeah.
That's right. You're standing right next to Louise Cohen, and I think that was around Hanukkah time, and you were doing the matches and the Hanukkah candles.
That's right. That's right. My mom remembered that tonight. That's amazing. That is amazing.
Jay, you're a hero. Thanks for coming on tonight. Thanks for all you do. It's great to have you as a neighbor here in Boca, and just keep doing it, because there's so many lessons from this conversation, right? Your message about optimism, your mom's last message about positivity and hope and not giving into the urge or inclination towards negative thoughts, of leaving your comfort zone, public speaking, blood, you, Becky, fear of needles, putting yourself out there. And the results are changing the world and saving lives.
Humility.
Each life saved is a world. And of course, Philip's bar mitzvah, which is the number one thing tonight. Still can't believe he didn't invite me. It doesn't matter that we didn't know each other and I'm older, but I'm still insulted by that. But I'm getting over it. I'm getting over it. What'd they serve at your bar mitzvah, Rabbi Moskowitz? Do you remember?
I don't know. I was too busy throwing up out of nerves. I don't remember any of it.
You did great.
Great things came out of it. Jay, thanks for being with us. And we look forward to, please God, bringing you and the whole movement back on to celebrate matches and to announce them and to keep more and more going. So, Jay, thanks for being with us tonight. We really appreciate it.
Jay, thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. Have a wonderful evening.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Rabbi Bro Day.
Yo.
Rabbi Brody, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for joining
Rabbi Brody,
the party.
Where are you coming from, Rabbi Brody?
Now, can you hear me now?
We can. Rabbi Brody, where are we finding you? Why were you late joining the show?
A long day traveling, got a little caught up, a little delayed, but we made it. You can see what my makeshift studio looks like right now.
Wow. Should we ask where you are?
Is that Fort Lauderdale or Palm Beach?
West Palm Beach.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They need better Wi-Fi there.
Well, it's good to have you back. Jay is a hero. Jay, everyone listening can hear, but we know, and Rabbi Moskowitz, you know better than anyone because you know Jay longest. He's just a humble, modest, soft-spoken guy. So like humble. There are people, we know other people that if they were the CEO in Jay's role, and if they accomplished a fraction of what Jay's accomplished, you'd never hear the end of it. It would be all about them. Jay is soft-spoken, modest, humble. He's a difference maker. He's just a great guy.
And also appreciative. You know, the fact that Jay maintains a connection with the people from 25 years ago, you should see when he gets in a room with my mother, the two of them, just the appreciation he has for people. Again, they hadn't seen each other in many years, but his level of appreciation for someone who ran a drive for him 25 years ago, and despite no matter how big he gets, no matter how much he accomplished, he always remembers that it's about people, and it's about caring about the people who have meant the most to you and been there along with the ride together with you. So he's a very special person, very near and dear to my heart, and has had an enormous impact on me. And I know you and so many others, you know, around the world. And
I hope that we lost a lot of our listeners right now who went right away and went to go order the kit and swab and save a life. But,
you know, just to put it in perspective, when he mentioned that their campaign or their annual budget is about $15.5 million, that's our annual campaign of our local federation.
Right.
You know, it's a one man's journey to build an empire. It's amazing.
And he's doing it. And he's doing it. All right. Hold on one moment, boys. All right, it's time for the Shame on You segment of this week. Unfortunately, every week we have something to point out, and there are those who say it doesn't belong in our show, but we think it does because, you know, we're not only here to have a good time and learn about amazing people and go behind the bima with them, but we have a responsibility to use our voice and speak truth to power, as they say. So unfortunately, another Shame on You segment, but actually this one is both a shame on you, and it's also a... It's also a hats off to you simultaneously.
Basically, you just like playing that. That's the bottom line.
No.
You just want an excuse.
It's both combined in one, and a big thank you to our listener and friend Donnie for sharing this with me. UC Merced, which is a college, part of University of California, unfortunately had to sanction or is looking into an engineering professor, Abbas Ghassemi, whose tweets crossed the line into, and I don't use this term lightly because, you know, Malcolm Homeline told us not to, but into anti-Semitism. And that's not us. That is AJC and several other Jewish organizations saying that they did. He tweeted really terrible, harmful things about Jewish students, about the Jewish people, and about the Jewish nation and our role here. And so on the one hand, there's the shame on you for this professor who said such horrible things, tweeted such horrible things. But at the same time, there's also a hats off to you, to the university itself, who is taking it very seriously, investigating it, sanctioning him, looking into it. And so simultaneously, really proud, the president said, the opinions presented in this Twitter account do not represent UC Merced, University of California. They were abhorrent and repugnant to us, to many of our colleagues and neighbors, harmful to our university, our students, and our years of work to build an inclusive and welcoming community. They are looking into it and investigating it. We must not let anti-Semitism, any form of bigotry or hate toward any group take root in the UC Merced community. So on the one hand, shame on you to that professor, but on the other hand, hats off to you, to the university, for tackling it head on, not tolerating it, and taking it on. So we're very, very gratified by that. So that is one thing. But we've got a second hats off to you. And the second hats off to you, many of you are following this story of my friend Gershon Distenfeld, his wife Aviva, who Gershon is a successful in finance. He is the co-head of fixed income and director of credit at AllianceBernstein. He's on CNBC, Bloomberg TV regularly, but he's also amateur until recently, poker player. He enjoys, and behind the beam is not taking any official position on poker, although recreationally and for fun, halachically it's not a problem. We're neither endorsing nor criticizing it. Statement of fact that he enjoys a little poker on the side, but he went from a hobby of playing poker to really actually excelling and earning a seat at the World Series of Poker, which is really amazing. But he did something that has, I'm not sure, ever been done before. The final game of the World Series of Poker main event took place this week. And before it took place, he pledged that whatever he won, and the winnings were over $1 million, I think, he was donating 100% of it to charity. He, in fact, I believe, named the charities. Okay, Booker's Own Synagogue was not on it, but that's okay. We'll forgive that.
Not yet.
NCSY Relief Missions, Yachad, Project Sarah, Stop Abusive Relationships at Home, and Minds Matter. And he came in. Spoiler alert, if you've what's it called? When you want to watch something later?
TiVo'd.
Okay. Just tells you I have no idea. I don't have it. But he, if you TiVo'd, it's
I heard for alert. A friend.
Don't listen right now. If you plan on still watching the main event of the World Series of Poker that happened 2 days ago, he came in eighth place and he won $126,000 and he is donating all of it to charity, which is really impressive. So shame. So Behind the Bima says hats off to you for that. It really is amazing that he made that commitment and he's following through on it. And it's a great example of his leadership. He and Aviva in this area and others. Kol hakavod. We take our hats off to you, Gershon. Really great job.
If you want to sponsor next week, I don't think we have a sponsor lined up yet.
That's a fair point. We don't have
a
sponsor.
That's a fair point.
Gershon Distenfeld, we can actually spend a couple minutes with him and talk about his strategies and game theory and maybe some financial tips too. So hats off to Gershon for that. It's really great. Boys, what else is going on? What else do you want to talk about in our final few minutes?
It's funny, when we were in camp growing up, so, you know, obviously late at night, it was oftentimes that people would play cards, sometimes poker may have been played. And the rule in camp was you weren't allowed to, and that if you were caught playing poker, any of the money on the table, they would burn it on the spot. That was the punishment. They would light it on fire, burn it, and then you learn your lesson.
I don't know if you should, really?
Yeah.
So the lesson was burn it. Maybe giving it to Stucco might have been a better lesson.
That was the deterrent. I won't say who it is now that you're pushing back a little bit. But once the head counselor comes in and he's about to do it, and one of the kids in the bunk looks at him, he's like, "But I'm giving it to Tzedakah. Right? This is all for the poor people. It's all for the needy.
For the poor people."
Didn't buy it. Went up in flames just with the rest of the cash there.
Gotcha. Not sure I'm loving the policy. I'm not sure that message. There are a lot of things that happened when we were younger that would never fly today. But burning money, not sure is the message you want the kids to go home with. But
I remember it.
Can I just say something which I just had a whole conversation with my mother-in-law about? Because we're talking about guns in Florida. I said, you don't remember. But when we were in Camp Oshava, when we went, we were 10 years old. They gave Simone, they gave us rifles. We were 10 years old shooting guns.
Yeah, they weren't doing that in Camp Misora. Instead, they were burning our money. But
we're at the end of the year, the end of the Gregorian year. And, you know, every rabbi gives that sermon every year, which we're not going to give, about comparing the secular New Year versus the way the Jewish New Year is observed.
Hindsight is 2020, right?
Yeah. So 2020 is coming to an end. And, you know, good riddance. I've written about a couple times that there's actually a group who have a good riddance ceremony in Times Square a couple days before the ball drops, where they people write down the things of the year before that they want to get rid of, and they shred it and burn it, not money, Rabbi Moskowitz, but they say good riddance to the things that they don't want to deal with anymore. There's a whole lot we want to say good riddance to. What in 2020 would you, if you never saw again, would you be okay with? What do you want to say good riddance to of 2020?
Oh, not even a question. Zoom school. If my kids never have to go to school virtually again, it'll be too soon.
Right.
Kids were meant for human interaction. They were meant to be with friends. They were meant to be in a classroom. Far and away, I think the most miserable part of the year, and I don't blame anyone, obviously that's what they had to do, but it was really torturous to manage many kids on Zoom.
Rabbi Brody, before you answer, let me just point out, of course it goes without saying that, you know, good riddance to Corona, good riddance to people being sick, good riddance to people dying.
That all
goes without saying. We're asking, you know, what's not obvious? What is the bane of your existence in the totally inconsequential, doesn't matter category that you want to say good riddance to? You'd be
more than happy. It's funny. Someone on Facebook wrote masks. Masks, honestly, I could deal. Mm-hmm. I could deal. Doesn't bother me.
You say that? I was thinking about saying masks. Yeah. I'm with Carrie.
Yeah.
Really? First of all, I just got a text to be negative, but not to be negative about the school. I wasn't. I said it's not the school's fault. Schools did the best job that they could. It's a very difficult situation.
Are you related to whoever wrote you that text?
I can neither confirm nor deny, but I have the utmost respect for the schools. But it was a really, really thankless position to be in, and it was very hard for parents in that position.
Wait, you know something? The schools would be the first ones, even before you, to say they would say correct to it. These teachers who are our unsung heroes had to learn new skill set and teach in a really difficult way, and they had to teach in a way that was unprecedented, which was they were now doing their job with all 20 kids in their class, parents looking over their shoulder while they were doing it, watching.
Correct.
That's a tough way to do a job. Rabbi Brody, what do you want to say good riddance to?
Yeah, I was going to say masks, but, you know, just thinking about it, I just want to say goodbye to Zoom. Yeah, I just, the whole concept, it's not just with school. I think it's with meetings. I think it's with the offices. I just want to meet with people. I want to get up in front of a crowd again. I want to get up in front of an audience and teach. And it's, you can't do it the same way on Zoom, even though you're reaching more people, you know, theoretically, like you're going to get a bigger audience online, but it's not the same as packing a room of people you can interact with.
Right. Yeah. I would say good riddance to all those things, all the above. The masks are rough for me. I do a lot of speaking in the masks, you know, the daily Dvar Torah between Mincha Maariv and Shabbos, the drushes we give. And, you know, the masks are rough. You breathe, you're smelling your own breath. You're fogging up your mask. If you're wearing glasses, your glasses, you know, the level of effort it takes to breathe in and breathe out. I'd be fine without the mask. But I'll tell you what my good riddance is too. I've now been tested 5 or 6 times. I think 6 times. Thank God I don't have COVID. I've never had COVID.
Up your nose.
But yeah, but between, you know, before we went to New York last summer, the wedding, and we got to New York and had to quarantine a couple times for being exposed. If no one ever stuck something up my nose to tickle my brain again, and I, you know, I have a pretty high tolerance for pain, so I do okay. Unlike, you know, others in my family, just say there's some family videos of people being tested and the kind of reactions and sounds that they make. I do okay. I'm pretty proud of that. But if I never had to know that feeling again of a sharp object tickling my brain, good riddance. I think I'd be just fine.
Now, what was an unexpected positive of 2020 that that you will cherish and relish going forward?
Again, you want consequential or inconsequential? Something big or something small and cute?
Something out of, no, whatever it is. First thing that comes to your mind, free thought.
So I'll tell you, inconsequential, I love that I didn't shake one hand this whole year. No sweaty palms, no, no hands, no. I mean, I love, people don't get me wrong. I'd rather give a hug than shake a hand any day. I'm a hugger. I like to connect, give a hug, share the love, but I'd be okay without the shaking hands.
Interesting. Rabbi Brody, how about you? Unexpected.
Hold on, hold on. We got a great answer to your question.
Avi Belzon, Rabbi Dr. Belzon.
Avi Belzon, behind the Bima.
Behind the Bima.
That is one good thing that came out.
Rabbi Brody, how about you? Unexpected, positive from 2020.
It's funny. I'm actually going to agree with Avi on this. I think that behind the Bima might be the biggest success. I'm not just saying, I like to say everything's the biggest and the best, but I really, really enjoy this. I think that this is going to stay. I think in 20 years when we're still doing it, we're going to look back and say, look. Look what season came out 20? Of it. Yeah, season 21.
Season 20. Who knows where we'll be? Or someone actually, we're not going to post it, but somebody, and I'm not sure what motivated them to use some app which would depict what we all look like in 20 years. I know, but here's the funny part. It depicts what we all look like in 20 years.
Yeah, you look exactly the same.
Because I'm already old. I'm not even going to make this joke, but I look already old. But the two of you are hilarious. But you got a text. I also got a text just now saying, don't knock masks and distancing. How many fewer colds did we all get this year? So truth to that. We all got a lot fewer colds this year. There's truth to that. And we're grateful to that. So good riddance. So good riddance to 2020. With 2021 will come Yeshiva week. Yeshiva week is different than usual. Obviously, people can't take the same vacations as normal. You guys doing anything?
No plans yet, but there's a lot of good deals out there.
Because
what if you get sick? It's annoying because you don't get anything back.
1 second. What are the good deals? Share with our listeners.
I saw there's a lot of great deals. You can fly. You can take vacations. I don't want to. I'll tell both of you. I don't want to. Anyone book a flight? I'm gonna be stuck here doing nothing.
But it's complicated, by the way, because you also, if you fly, a lot of schools have rules about when you get back, quarantining, where you go, how you do it. Rabbi Moskowitz and I were talking earlier today also, and I don't want to get in trouble for this one, but we and many other adults, men, women.
Are you going there?
I'm going there. Okay. Let's say there's a big difference between a family trip and a vacation. There's a big difference.
Right.
Family trip and vacation. What is the difference?
Family.
Family trip is beautiful. You get to spend time with your kids. You get to make everlasting memories, but it's not vacating. Vacating is relaxation. It's enjoyment. It being with your children, while it's the greatest blessing in the world, it is sometimes more stressful and exhausting than not being with your kids. And so, and the proof is, by the way, the first day back, from family trips, when you show up to school that day, let's say the doors open at 7:45, By 7:40, there's a line out the door of parents waiting to drop their kids off so that they can deposit them in school and go back to work. So,
I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that often after a family trip, you need a vacation, but you've never come back from a vacation saying, I could really use a family trip. Now, by the way, I'm with you. It's a blessing. You know, the last thing we'd ever, if you have a family, you're blessed. Never complain for one moment. If you have a family, you have children, you have people to travel with, it is not a complaint. It is the greatest blessing in the world. All we're saying is there's a difference between a family trip and a vacation, and we shouldn't confuse the two. That's all we're saying. Let's end with this. Gentlemen, what would be your dream vacation, and what would be your dream family trip? If you could take your children, your family, and go anywhere, what would and where would that be? And your vacation, your dream vacation, what would that look like?
Oh, so for me, I'll jump in. Sorry. my family has never, I've never taken my family to Israel yet. We were hoping to go last summer before my son's bar mitzvah that obviously did not pan out. So without a doubt, my dream family vacation is to be able to take my entire family to Israel, hands down.
Amazing. That is good. Rabbi Brody?
I got to agree with Rabbi Moskowitz there. Can't wait. I'm counting down the days till they lift that restriction and all those quarantines, and you can just go back to Israel. I think we're all ready just to book that flight.
100%. For people who go to Israel fairly regularly, I don't mean regularly like weekly or monthly, but you know, usually go at least once a year, it's been like depleted. It's one of the unspoken casualties of Corona is, you know, the energize. That's like not plugging
it's
in
like
your
the
phone.
The shot in the arm. Yeah.
Yeah, the inability to plug in and recharge that spiritual battery, that experience, the family members that we're not seeing. As great as the technology is, and I have to disagree a little bit with Brody on this, the gift of the technology has enabled us, you know, to I spend time with my grandson every day. I haven't gotten him to say Zeta yet, but I mean, I heard it once, let's be honest, but nobody else heard it. Nobody was there. Wasn't.
If in your mind you heard it, that's all that matters.
No, I heard it. There's no question about it. I just haven't been able to duplicate it yet. We'll get there. But they get without technology, you couldn't do that, but it's been really hard. But what is your dream? Let's end with this. What's your dream vacation? Are you like, I want to be busy 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. running around doing hiking? Or are you the, give me a safer and a book, give me a beach overlooking the ocean?
I'm up at 6 a.m. Davening, running, learning, working out. Like it could be argued by some members of my family that I need to learn how to vacate in a different fashion, one that requires a little bit more of relaxation. But I am a like get up at 6 a.m. and maximize every second of that vacation.
Yeah, but that's what I do every day. So now I want to take a break from that.
Right.
No, but it's different stuff. It's different stuff on vacation.
Yeah, it's readable.
It's not just as rabbis. I'm not trying to cut you off. Just nobody can hear you, Rabbi Brody. So I don't feel bad.
Sorry.
Not a problem. But I think, you know, anybody who's accountable. So you always have to be answering, preparing, responding, meeting on. I just want to, when I need to vacate the vacation, recreation, recreate, I just need to turn off. I need to go through a period where I have no accountability to anyone. So part of the challenge of your vision, Rabbi Moskowitz, and it works for you, it's not a criticism, but for me is then you still got that schedule. I got to do this and I got to feel guilty if I'm not on schedule.
No, I don't have to.
I got to maximize it that way. And I've got to, I just want to shut off.
The beauty
of it. I'm not accountable to anything.
No. But I do it on my own schedule, right? In other words, you get up, you die. I can learn when I want. I can go for a run when I want. By the way, I can go for however long I want. I don't have to be back at a certain time. So to me, that's the freedom, even within the maximizing. But I love feeling accomplished on vacations. Like, I don't want to say at the end of vacation, I sat and read for a week. Like, to me, that's not
the vacation. It's funny because to me, that's the vacation. I got a pile of books that sit until there's a vacation, because that's when I have the margin, the headspace, the quiet. I like to read, then I go for a walk and I process, I think about, and I come back and I have like all these ideas. I want to change my life. I want to change the world. You know, that's the goal for me, is to create the space and the quiet to be able to actually think, where there's not this motion sickness of just the next thing, responding, defense,
rat
keep going.
Race, yeah. Well, let's come back to that, because Jay said one of the most profound lessons he ever learned from this mentor, Bill Beagle, was the big, hairy, audacious goal. And he has his big, hairy, audacious goal. Rabbi Goldberg, what is your big, hairy, audacious goal?
I have several. We're going to start with that next week because we are over time. let's make sure we get to that. No, I'm so pumped about that our listeners don't have enough time between now and Shabbos to hear that answer. So people want to know our reading list. Maybe we'll share our reading list. Mm-hmm. We'll give a little end of the year vacation time reading list. Maybe people want to jump on board. We could have a big book club. And we'll talk about our big audacious goals. I don't know why they have to be hairy, but big audacious goals. And we'll start with that next time. So big thank you to Jay for joining us. He posted in the chat a video. You can learn more about the case that the drive is happening for right now. Everybody check it out. If you've not been swabbed, be swabbed. You can change a life. Rabbi Brody, we're happy you made it in the end. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Rabbi Moskowitz, we're happy you had a bar mitzvah. Look how much that did for the world. Who knew so much good could come from Boston? Whoever knew? Anyway, on that note, stay happy, stay healthy, stay holy. Wishing everyone a great Shabbos. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to Behind the Bima. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next week for another peek behind the Bima.